Chapter 9. Gene Aldrich was the most patient fisherman I've ever seen. I was not very enthusiastic when he announced he was going to try to stab a fish with the pocket knife. I figured it would occupy his mind and provide some amusement anyway, so I made no objection. He would lean out over the boat, poised and ready. Whenever a fish near the surface would venture too close to the edge of the boat, Gene would swing down with the knife, but the wise little creatures were too agile. Tony, meanwhile, was lying in the bottom of the boat, dozing. I was watching Gene's maneuvers warily. If the boat got punctured, we would indeed be in a bad way. One fish, about the size of a freshwater perch, the kind we used to call a pumpkin perch, was especially curious. He kept swimming up close, slipping over on his side and gazing out of one eye at the strange yellow thing, our boat. Then he came a little too close. Gene stabbed viciously. His knife caught the fish right amidships, the blade going almost completely through. Gene whipped the fish into the boat with one continuous motion of his arm. The fish fell from his knife and dropped on Tony. That brought Tony out of his dozing in a hurry. Quick as a cat, he rolled over on top of the little fish. He doubled his arms close to his chest and pressed his body down like a football player on top of a fumbled ball. Tony lay on the fish until it stopped struggling. When he was sure it was dead, he lifted it by the tail, holding it gingerly and well into the center of the boat, so there would be no possibility of our losing it. "Chow," he said reverently. "Come on, let me scale it," Gene said, reaching out his hand. He took the fish and laid it carefully on the forward thwart. With the knife, he scraped off the scales, working carefully and thoroughly. Then he handed the knife to me. "You divide it, Chief." I cut the fish into three equal pieces. "I never ate raw fish before," Gene said a little squeamishly. "Well, the Hawaiians eat raw fish," I answered. "Don't worry, I'll eat it," he declared. Each of us gnawed off a small bite. We had no saliva in our mouths, and trying to masticate the raw flesh was like chewing gum. The moist innards went down a little better. "The liver's good for you," I said, and divided this organ among us. We ate as much as we could of this fish, but it was poor fare for our first meal in 7 days. None of us had ever tasted raw flesh before, and in spite of our long fast, we were wary of it. The dryness of our mouths and throats made it extremely difficult to swallow. We didn't want to eat it all at once anyway. After we had eaten as much as we could, there was a sizable portion left. This I wrapped in one of the rags I had torn from Tony's shirt. I stored it in the bow of the boat. "There's a meal for later," I said. This was our lucky day. That afternoon, it rained again. Our method of catching water hadn't been too successful the first time. We didn't really get enough for our needs, and I'd been casting about in my mind for a better scheme. I hit upon the idea of soaking the rainwater up in rags. I made the boys take off their underdrawers, and I took mine off too. I cut them along the inside seams, making of each pair one rag about 30 inches long by 14 inches wide. These worked quite satisfactorily. The drawers were of absorbent cotton material and seemed to pick up the water as fast as it came down. In the beginning, we used the shirt rags too. We could see this second squall coming. The rain came up very fast, especially the last 100 feet. Then it seemed to hit us all at once. This time we were prepared. The boys made a trough of the oar pocket, and I wrung out the rags as fast as I could. When we had sufficient water, we formed the oar pocket into a little runoff, and thus poured the water into the water bottle. This water bottle was a bag-like receptacle that closed with a zipper. It had been put in the boat as a bailer, but we had a better use for it. The squall was a short one. In this part of the South Pacific, squalls never last longer than 15 minutes at the most. Normally they last from 3 to 5 minutes, but they hit with a bang and the water falls in sheets so thick you can only see a few yards. Our rags were always heavily impregnated with salt, and before they could do us any good as water catchers, we had to rinse them out. Often, before we had them freshened, the squall would be gone. There was always a lot of wind in the squalls. One seemed to bring the other. The wind was very sharp, whipping up quick surface waves that would ride over the ground swells, and often the squalls brought a reversal of wind, or a wind that crossed the previous direction. This condition always made nasty little waves that jumped in the air and plopped in the boat, sometimes throwing a couple of gallons of salt water over our water-catching rags. This meant that we would have to rinse them again, losing precious time in the brief shower. This time, however, we all had a good drink. This, on top of our first food, made us feel very much better. After the rain had passed, we took off all our clothes. We sloshed the sodden garments in the bottom of the boat, soaking up the excess water which was useless for drinking because it was saltier, from washing the brine-coated fabric, than the sea itself. We wrung our clothes over the side and put them on again, refreshed. The rain had washed the atmosphere as well as us. It was late afternoon and the sun's rays were softer. There was a good breeze from northeast by north. All hands felt better than at any time since the first day. I'd been lying on my back for perhaps a half hour, my eyes closed, when there was a terrific explosion. I came out of the bottom of the boat like a streak of lightning. My ears were ringing. In fact, I haven't been able to hear again out of my right ear to this day. But I hadn't time to think of my roaring eardrum then. Jean had shot an albatross. The bird had alighted on the stern of the boat about 6 inches above my head. Jean was sitting on the forward thwart, facing aft. This put him about 5 feet from the bird. Slowly, his eyes fastened on the albatross, he reached down and picked up the gun. Gripping the .45 in both hands, he aimed carefully and fired. The blast went directly across my face. The muzzle of the gun was hardly an inch from my ear. The slug caught Mr. Albatross in the center of the breast and plowed the length of his body. The bullet missed his heart but scrambled his innards some. The impact knocked the big bird several feet into the water. These details I learned later. As I leaped up under the shock of that shattering blast, Jean and Tony were yelling, "Get him! Get him! Don't let him get away!" The bird's carcass was drifting slowly away from the boat, but in their excitement, neither Tony nor Jean was making any move to do anything about it. I took in the situation at a single glance. Instantly, I dived over the side. Whether I was strong enough to swim, the possibility of my being able to get back to the boat never occurred to me. I struck out after the floating body of the albatross. A few strokes, and my fingers closed in his feathers. I was back aboard before the boat had drifted 20 feet. We tried to pluck the bird, but we found it impossible to pull out the feathers, so we skinned it with the pocket knife. None of us was very hungry after eating the heart, liver, and other organs, including the entrails. We put the rest of the meat in the bow with the fish, intending to eat it for breakfast the next morning. Naturally, we recalled the ancient mariner's curse. I knew that all seamen since olden times have held the albatross in great awe and believed it sacred. Like the average person, perhaps I've always been just a little inclined to believe in good luck and bad luck. I didn't think much about it at the time, but later I was none too happy over Aldrich's feat in shooting the albatross. My watch came around at about midnight. I got up and took over. It was very dark tonight. After sitting a while in the after thwart, I noticed a glow of light in the bow. It was so strong that it illuminated the entire boat and the sea around. It seemed to be coming from our pile of rags. I got down and untangled the rags until I came upon the meat we had saved from the fish and the carcass of the albatross. They were strongly phosphorescent, especially the bird. When I held it up, the albatross glowed like a flashlight, particularly the tail, which seemed as bright as an incandescent bulb. The fish glowed where it had lain against the bird. I aroused the two boys. "What do you think of that?" I said. We gazed at the stuff for a moment or two, not wishing to make the decision that we knew we must. "Looks like it's spoiled, all right," Tony said slowly. Jean came right to the point. "I don't know about you fellas," he said, "but I wouldn't feel like eating any more of that." "What makes that?" Tony asked. I explained phosphorescence and pointed out that phosphorus was poison. "It might be dangerous to eat any more of it," I concluded reluctantly. "Damn, albatross poisoned the fish, too," Tony said. The fish meat emitted a soft green light only where it had lain against the albatross. "Yeah, better heave it all," Jean said, looking down. Without further talk, I threw the whole mess into the sea. Later it occurred to me that I should have saved it for bait. As a matter of fact, I found out later that it wouldn't have been dangerous to eat the albatross at all. The flesh of an albatross is phosphorescent as a rule, I learned, because it preys largely upon luminous fish. The rest of the night passed uneventfully until just before daylight, when the wind shifted to the west. I rigged the sea anchor. In about an hour, the wind changed again, shifting back to almost due north, and I took the anchor back in, and we continued on our way south. As soon as the sun was up, Jean had out the knife and was trying to stab another fish. Our stomachs had been stimulated by the few bites we had, and now the hunger began to claw the walls of our bellies with red-hot fingers.